John Wallace. I'm an economist. I teach at the University of Maryland. I've been talking this week about sort of problems of how society is organized to promote or not promote economic and political and social development. I really had to sit on my hands during Bible study this morning. At Holden, one of the great things that happens is that things interconnect. Yesterday I talked on Monday about sort of just some simple, they're really not very simple, but ideas about, sort of why countries that are poor are poor, the importance of promoting economic, if we're really concerned about poverty and justice, that economic development is a major cure for poverty and injustice, even though some of us have a thing that all the country we live in is unjust and all that sort of thing. That doesn't really work when you look around the world. So I began to talk yesterday about how we can think about how societies are actually organized, and I came up with, I presented two sort of principles of social orders. Yesterday I talked about violence and social orders. And one is limited access, where in effect the political system and the dominant group, which is usually relatively small, are Chris and Mark for today.
Someone else is going
to have it. There's Mark. And he's now in charge, he's taken over. Tyranny and slavery will fall. That we had limited access and open access societies. I'll be talking more about that today. And I hope that all of you at the Bible study who were at my session yesterday immediately thought about limited access when Bradley read this sentence. Talking with him, Peter went inside and found a large gathering of people. This was at Cornelius' house. Peter said to them, "You are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with a Gentile or visit him." I hope you all thought limited access. There's no openness in the society. There's Jews, there's other people, and they're different. I'm going to talk today a lot about organizations. It's very important, so we're going to talk about corporations, evil or good. And we want to talk about organizations in general. Brad has already talked about identity today. That limited access is enormously important in identifying yourself with a particular group. And the law said you don't associate with each other. This was not just how people felt about themselves and their identity. This was an identity that was rooted in a larger social reality. This is a social construction of reality. The world in which these people lived, people were different because of their identity. Okay? Don't think that world, being a Jew and a Gentile, were not different things. It's hard for us to think about that in our society. Because even with respect to race and black and white and immigrants and non-immigrants, we've got no barriers like those barriers were. Or what the difference between a Roman and a non-Roman was, and what a citizen was. Okay? Then Peter began to speak. I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but accepts men from every nation who fear him and do what is right. There is an open access message in the gospel. Okay. There's also nations. Are these nations like our nations? No, they're not. These were nations, people of different nations who lived in the same community, side by side. Right? It was part of their identity. So you had a society in which identity for people who lived homogeneously in the same neighborhood, cheek to jowl, was different. And so they were organized in different ways. Some of those organizations were formally legal. Some of them were informally legal. Some of them were just norms of behavior and identity. But limiting access to certain groups and identifying others was incredibly important to this process of identity. Yesterday we talked about human nature and that the typical societies are organized in groups of 25, and we are literally wired to do that. Okay? That we recognize people that we know. We have three brains. Does everybody know that? You have a reptilian brain, which is a brain that we share with many kinds of animals, and the reptilian brain, its basic function is to regulate how your body works. So things you don't feel things happening in your reptilian brain necessarily, like when it's hot and you sweat and you do those kind of things.
Although, in fact, a lot of emotions are, in fact, linked to the reptilian brain. Just when things are going wrong, your body tells you that things are going wrong by changing the way you feel. Okay. So when you feel an emotion, right, your body starts doing things. You shake, you cry. Great actors are people who can make their body do the things that exhibit the emotion. Most of us can't do that. Okay? We have a second level brain called a limbic brain. Reptiles don't have limbic brains. Alligators eat their own babies. Dogs don't. Why? How many of you have a dog? I have three at the moment. Can you tell when your dog's happy or sad? Can your dog tell when you're happy or sad? Your dog can tell when you're pissed. Why? Because, in fact, we're endowed with an ability to sense emotions in others. And this is not just by looking at visual clues, right? We can sense what people are doing. You know, yesterday I was talking too much. I could sense that Chris was getting bored. He was doing this stuff. It wasn't just the way he looked. You know, there's more than that. Okay? Those of you who were at Heidi's session yesterday, we're talking about Augustine, and that in fact, babies have this automatic, really, really, really deep connection with their mother. Okay? They feel that. In fact, you know, infant death syndrome, where babies suddenly die, is much more likely to happen if they're not sleeping in the same room with their parents. Okay? If you just put a metronome in the room, that's better. Because they need that, because they don't know how to make the mechanism work yet. So they're automatically tuned into this, let's listen to other people. There's a great book I read this winter called A General Theory of Love by people whose names I can't remember, which is about the limbic system. And it's the theory, they're all psychologists, and it's about how, in fact, people sense things from others, and children learn what kind of emotions are good and bad. Right? They learn how they should respond to their own feelings by actually feeling the feelings of their parents, the people around them. And so if you have a parent who's abusive, you have a parent who doesn't love you, who does not pay attention, that you learn the right responses. Of course, those responses turn out to be problematic later on. I was talking to Ingrid yesterday about privilege, and she was talking about her father and mother. My family is filled with marvelous people, which is this tremendous gift that I have. You know? And I couldn't get it without feeling my parents and my grandparents and, you know, Paul and Carol and their parents and all the people at Holden, you know. And I learned to be who I am from them. Not by writing down notes and studying and taking exams, but because I can feel the people around me. And then we have this neocortex. We have this brain that operates up here that's rational and irrational and all these kinds of things. It's interesting, in the neocortex, there's something called mirror neurons. If Rick, lift your hand up. All around the room, your brains and your neocortex are firing the neurons to raise your hand because you saw Rick do it. Okay? No, because you can see what he's doing. Now, that's why bands of 25 can work, because we can see and feel the people around us. But when we move to a higher level of organization, we see people who we don't know, and we're smart enough to understand that the same emotions don't produce the same things in everybody. And I gotta know what that expression means from you. And if I don't know, I can't trust you as deeply as if I really do know you. Paul and I were talking last night. I met Paul when I was 15. He was 18. Now, we've known each other for a really, really, really long time, which makes for this very deep connection. You know, and it happens, boom, as soon as we see each other. Wham. So how does societies get beyond that to get organized is a really tough thing, particularly because the tendency with respect to others, right, which Brad was talking about this morning, is hard. So we have rules. We have to have a social structure in order to get to the others to make our societies bigger. And as I talked about yesterday, that works with limiting access, okay, to control the problem of violence. kinds of corporations are there in the United States today? Anybody know? When I say corporations, what do you think of? Big, yeah, General Motors, Ford, Exxon, Mobil. What's Holden Village?
Corporation.
It's a corporation. What's the Lutheran church you belong to? It's a corporation, unless you live in Virginia, in which case it's a trust. No, Virginia has a different law with respect to how churches organize themselves. They don't have a general incorporation law for churches, so that you have to form a different form of organization. What about the city you live in?
It's
an incorporation. Okay. What about the political parties we're going to vote for? Ah, they're very interesting. It's not clear they're corporations. Okay. We're going to talk about that. Okay. Corporations are not just businesses. They're more than that, and we need to think about how organizations are formed and how they're supported by the larger society. When we think about natural states or limited access orders, which are societies in which a relatively small number of people at the top enjoy big privileges, and here I don't mean the privilege like I got from my parents. But that's a gift. This is a privilege that the larger society actually enforces. The Pope is infallible. And of course, that doesn't happen until like 1870 that they actually declared him infallible.
He wasn't
infallible before that. I'm not really so sure about it now. Okay, but that's something that that's a behavior that everybody agrees to abide by. So it's got to have this social both compliance and structure to it. Okay. There, Brad was talking, and we had the forum on Monday night about the law of the church. And those things aren't laws. Okay? They're not individual optional choices. Because unless we all collectively agree to that, right? And that's what a law says. It doesn't matter. You don't have a choice to obey the law or not. Because we've all collectively decided if you don't obey the law, we're going to punish you. The big issue when Ingrid's talking about with capital punishment. Certain kinds of behaviors are punishable by death. And you don't have a choice. Of course you have choices. I can try to break the law or do that. But having the social agreement is a tough thing. And of course societies do not automatically come to that. The mechanism by which this is going to come out is through these elites, these hierarchies. And so what you see in societies, I can think about our six guys. This dominant coalition that was Chris and Mark and Leo and Nathan and Aaron and Tom. Right? You can identify them. In fact, when I identified them, I actually identified that personally they possessed privileges which everybody else in the room did not. I changed their identity vis-a-vis all of us. Okay? But it was incredibly important that their identity was attached to them. Because it matters who Mark is. If Mark is a doofus, he's dead. If you have a general who's incompetent, right?
Sometimes.
Because it mattered that he could, in fact, hold this thing together. The personality of these guys and their identity really matters. We're talking about getting a bigger society in which we cannot personally know everybody. I personally know Mark, right? And I don't personally know some of you. Some of you I've gotten to know this week, okay? But we all know who these guys are if we're participating in the society. Everybody knows who the pharaoh is, and the chief priest, and the bishop, and the pope, and the king, and the dukes, and the earls. They have identities that are unique to them as people, and are part of the social structure. And part of what happens, I'm only going to draw a couple of these, is that these guys, and initially in most human societies are guys, no matter how much you try to read the Bible, put the women in there. Okay, these are societies that are dominated by men. Right, property ownership is dominated by men. In many societies, women can't own property. There's a bunch of stuff they can't do. That may be unjust and unfair. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying
I'm going to call these guys guys because they probably were. They sit on top of organizations. In fact, we didn't just need Mark and Chris to be powerful. We needed to have them connected in with Tom and Aaron, the economic specialists, who were able to mobilize resources, and Leo and Nathan, who were the priests, or the religious structure, you know, took in the offerings and then redistributed it back. And in fact, the most important right that these guys possess is the fact that they had an organization, may not have a legal structure, but that they're, the easiest way to think of this is as a patronage network. Here's the boss. He's got some lieutenants, and there's a lot of peons. And everybody in the society knows whose network they're part of. I am a Jew. I'm not a Gentile. And if stuff hits the fan, the Jews stick together. Right? I'm a blood. I'm not a Christian. Right? I'm a member of this group, not a member of that group. And when stuff starts to happen, I know whose side I'm on. And I'm a Hutu, not a Tutsi, in Rwanda. And boy, if you live in a society with violence, you better know which one of these networks you're part of. Because if violence breaks out, everybody who's not in one of these networks is dead. Okay? Because you need your band of brothers around you who are bound by that interest to hold together. These guys are much, much wealthier than anybody in the hierarchy. This is a limited access society. Is it impossible for somebody to rise from here to here?
No.
No, it's perfectly possible for that to happen. And it happens all the time, okay? But the only way to get to the top is through this organization. Now, these societies are organized this way so that there's, somebody was saying, we were talking about Kenya, that the, who was it, Diana was talking about the number of tribes, you know, how many are there in Kenya?
There's 44.
44 in Zambia or Zimbabwe?
Tanzania, 121.
Right, so that there already is in existence this tribal structure, which is very much patron-client oriented. In fact, almost every place in the world is organized in patron-client terms. So. You know, there's this great thing, China. Where's this kid here? No. So I got to go to China. We were supposed to drive to Tiananmen Square to go to the Forbidden City, which is on the, I think it's on the north side of the square. But my wife was tired of driving, so she made our hosts walk, which they really didn't want to do. We had to walk like 5 miles. So we walked to the north end of Tiananmen Square, I mean, the north end of the Forbidden City, and walked through the Forbidden City backwards, because usually you go through from the Tiananmen Square into the Forbidden City and around. And this place is huge. They have this big examination hall where all these people would come to take their civil service exams and all this stuff. It's really impressive. And if you've been in China, especially if you've been outside of Beijing where there's all this poverty, the contrast is just enormous between the emperor and his retainers and all the people that are in the system and the rest of the population. And you walk out, the walls on the Forbidden Palace are like 100 feet thick. And this was clearly a place that was defensible. Okay? And you walk out into Tiananmen Square, and you turn around, and guess what's over the main gate?
Mom.
A picture of Mao. Picture of Mao. Boy, whoa! That's an organizing principle in this society. Get in it, these guys. You don't mess with. Right? And in fact, what Mao did, and Kit talked particularly on Monday about how problematic this was for the Chinese society and economy, said, we have got to get rid of all of this structure. So we're going to take everybody who's at the top and put them out on the farms. We're going to reorganize the entire society. Now, in the process of doing that, China got really, really poor. And in fact, China in the 1950s underwent all these civil wars where it was being ruled by, anybody remember what Kit said?
Warlords.
In fact, these kind of coalitions are very unstable and oftentimes they break apart so that you've got, you really have a hierarchy of these things in most societies.
So personality and identity in a society where there's lots of violence is really, really important, and it is personal identity. And your identity, if you're down here, it does not mean that you can't get any justice, and it does not mean you get any protection, but you get it by being part of the network of somebody who's connected up here. And if you're in a network that's not well connected, you suffer. So the privileges that are created that hold the dominant coalition together are not just the fact that they're rich. It's the fact that they are in a position to have organizations that the coalition will enforce. You know, Mark and Chris are there to make sure if these guys get out of line, there's a collective ability to discipline people within the organization. So, one of the things that we really need to understand about most societies is that the ability to form an organization that the larger society will support, which I will call, for ease of exposition, a contractual organization. That is, and let me contrast that to its opposite, which is we call an adherent organization. A voluntary organization where everybody just belongs because it's in their interest to belong, does not have any sort of outside third party, is capable of doing lots of things. The problem with being an adherent organization is everybody who participates is participating voluntarily. So on any given day, some people might not show up. Okay? So a contractual organization has this benefit. There's no clock in here, so I have to keep looking at my clock. Great. Of having third-party enforcement, somebody outside. That person could be the Pope, it could be the pastor, it could be anybody, an authority figure. Typically we think of that as being the government, being the state. That within a contractual organization, you can make arrangements over time. So if, Diane, it's Diane, right? Not Diane, okay. So if Diane loans me money, I have a very strong incentive not to pay her back. Okay, especially once I get the money. We're going to talk about this tomorrow in Jubilee. This notion of forgiving debts. Okay, go read Leviticus 25 tonight, and because that's what Jubilee is about. Don't just read the three sentences about forgiving debts. Read all 57 verses about property law and labor law in Jewish society. Okay, because it's about structuring relationships over time. If we have a purely adherent relationship organization, she loans me money and I don't repay. She's only going to believe I'm going to repay if she really sees it's in my strong interest for me to remain related to her. Okay? Because, so there's some benefit from us being together. But if we have a contract, I don't know anybody at Bank of America, yet I send them $2,700 a month. And I send this huge amount to pay for my mortgage. Why? Because if I don't, the state of Maryland will actually come and kick me out of my house and give it to Bank of America. There's a real third party element there. These organizational structures that members of the elite head can draw on this larger society to enforce their agreements within their organizations. Whereas the rest of us down here can't. If you look across societies at the number of organizations, it's dramatically different between the developed 25 countries and the rest of the world. As Kit said yesterday in China, on Monday about China, in China, if you're an organization, you better be associated with the Communist Party. You better be associated with the state. Okay? And that's true throughout the developing world. They have relatively small numbers of organizations, and the organizations that exist are typically tied in with the government, or tied in with the coalition. And this is true even of organizations that have what appear to be very Western, their corporations and that sort of thing. And what happens in Latin America when there's a revolution to all the newspapers? Yeah. In fact, the newspapers that persist or the television stations are typically ones that are closely connected to the government. Okay. Even though we can see the forms of organizations in these other places, we typically see very, very few. You may have heard of the work of Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone. Have you heard of that book?
It's about American society and civil society, and to the extent to which American society is organized. And in fact, whether that's going up or down, you know, we all believe that having a lot of organizations is really good for civil society. We'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about open access. But that most societies don't have a lot of organizations. And organizations are a threat. They're a threat to the existing coalition. So that doesn't mean people are not part of organizations. It means the organizations that they're part of typically are these networks that contain an element of violence and are very, very important in establishing identity. We're talking on Monday night at the forum about the law of the church. The Lutheran Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, is not an inherent organization, it's a contractual organization. People are free to leave and go as they want, but there in fact is a very important legal structure that the church enforces. And it's really, really important that those laws are there, even if people don't like them. Why? Because that's part of religious freedom. Okay? Allowing the Lutheran Church to exist under exactly the same set of rules that the Catholic Church exists in the United States is an incredibly important part of religious freedom for both Lutherans and Catholics, and evangelicals, and of a whole mix. As soon as we start going after mosques and saying, you shouldn't be a congregation because you're a terrorist, we threaten every single church. Because as soon as those laws become special for Lutherans, like they are in Sweden, or used to be, are they still? Is the Lutheran Church still the church, state church in Sweden?
Yes.
It used to be?
Yes.
Anglican Church was the church, was the state church in Virginia. In the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, you were required, and in the Constitution, to tithe. Everybody was required to tithe to support a church. And if your church was not on the approved list, which all turned out to be Anglican, not really Anglican, they were Puritans. They were, what would they become, Paul? Congregationalists. If your church was not on the approved list, you had to pay a 10% of your income to the state, who would then distribute it to the approved churches. Religious freedom? Ooh, kind of tough there. Kind of tough there. You know, we're going to see. Maybe the United States doesn't really start out with open access. It has all these kind of things. Part of religious freedom is the freedom to form an organization. It's not just the freedom to have freedom of conscience, to believe what you want to believe, which, yeah, you can do that in your basement. Freedom of religion means your ability to build your own church, to have a national organization, and if you don't have structures that enable you to do that, it's very hard to do it. And believe me, when one church gets it, they have a strong incentive to prevent all the other churches from getting it. Don't think Christianity is inevitably equated with openness. It's not. And if you think of Christians as tolerant, read their history. Part of the Lutheran tradition is the reforming tradition against the limited access of the Catholic Church, which was an intimate part of the coalition of Western Europe. Okay. So one of the things that we really want to understand, both about ourselves and about our society, is how do societies come to this ability to create open access, okay, to allow people, but it also means that they have to come to the ability to support organizations and define them clearly in such a way that they can allow everybody access to them. Because just saying everybody's equal doesn't work in a natural state. Because if everybody's equal and everybody's violent, it's chaos, and what will emerge out of that is this kind of structure. It'll have different names, different places. It'll have different forms, it'll have different norms, it'll have different cultural implications. We'll call it tribal in Africa, we'll call it patriot networks in South America, we'll call it something different in Asia, I'm not sure what they call it. But we'll see this kind of structure emerging. And this is not how our society looks. Okay, our society looks like. You mean the Democratic Party organization? Are you kidding? Okay, so how do we get there? What I want to do
then, does anybody have any questions about this kind of, because these are big circles, like I was talking about yesterday, kind of thinking about these organizations, and it is really, we tend to swim in a society that has lots of organizations, and we take it for granted that the ability to organize is part of society, because most of us move in and out of organizations freely. We assume that those organizations are just voluntary. They come together. Anybody's ever tried to organize a soccer league or a potluck dinner? You know, that voluntarism is not all scrapped up to be. Right? You know, try to organize a soccer league and figure out the problem of who's going to get sued when a kid breaks his leg. You definitely want to be in a contractual world where somebody has got an insurance policy that protects you against that liability. You definitely want to live in a world where the property rights, where if somebody is negligent and you get hurt, your kid gets hurt, you can get compensation, which in a limited access world only occurs because you go to the patron and say, that guy hurt me, let's go kill him. Now you want to go to insurance, you want to go to some impersonal, you know, State Farm. Who's the person who's telling me about State Farm? Oh, Pete, is Jeff here? Jeff lives in Normal, Illinois. There's two employers, the state, Illinois State and State Farm.
Okay, he's a pastor of the Church of State Farm.
It's actually called, no,
yeah. And his ministry is to State Farm employees, so that's what he said. It was really neat. So how do we get there? Well, one of the things that we really, really need to keep track of, and it comes out when we talk about the story about Caesar, okay, and all the stuff in the Bible. This is a time when the Roman Republic, which is not really a democracy, but is this large, growing entity, becomes an empire with an emperor, with one guy. Augustus Caesar is really the first. Okay? He's the adopted son of Julius Caesar. His original name was Octavian. He becomes the emperor. And in Roman society, what pleases the emperor is law. In a formal sense, the emperor is above the law. Okay? He's powerful. He's all-powerful. He's the emperor. Okay? So, but of course, does the emperor rule by himself? This is never one guy. It's never, ever one guy. It's always a group. It's always a coalition of interest at the top. Now, sometimes that coalition, we select one guy to be the nominal head, but we constrain him not by the threat of revolution, but by the threat of the other people in the coalition who are dangerous to him. So the emperor comes out, Augustus, it comes out of a period of civil war. And what are those civil wars caused by? Does anybody know? Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon. What does that mean? He brings the German army, the army of Rome that's in Germany, into Rome, which you're not supposed to do, because the army is supposed to stay out of Rome and be governed by the Senate. That's the Republican institution. And so you get a war, and I'm going to get the wrong name, so you get a three-way war between armies. You know, it's Julius Caesar and Mark Antony, right? It's going to be Octavian and Pompey. Right, so you're going to get these civil wars between the Roman armies, and what they say is the armies are collectively going to pick a guy to be the emperor. And for most of Roman history, there are good emperors and bad emperors. But when things really fall apart, the emperor needs the control and the approval of the army. This is not political control of the military. This is military control of the political. So the emperor, who cannot command the allegiance of the army, cannot lead, and that's why this becomes an empire rather than a republic. Under the Senate, under the Republican institutions, the army responded to the collective decision making of the Senate, which was not a democracy, it was an aristocracy. But in the civil wars of the first century AD, the Senate proved itself incapable of regulating the armies that were necessary to govern this entire empire. And so Augustus, which we are, you know, in the reign of Augustus Caesar, you know, I used to be part of a Christmas tree. You know, we recite that at Christmas, you know. And so Augustus is the savior. Because this society is about to splinter. It is splintering into factions, and Augustus brings it together. Out of that, at the same time, the church is going to build on Christ and the gospel. It's going to have lots of interesting history, which I don't know as much about as I would like to. Have Eusebius. Eusebius is one of the first historians of the church, who was a bishop under Justinian.
Constantine.
Well, Constantine. Was he? He wasn't. Yeah. Thank you. Paul knows a lot more about everything than I do. So he's kind of like my reference guide. I could Google things, but I just ask Paul. That writes about the early church. Okay. Well, what happens under Constantine is that the Christian church becomes the official state religion of Rome. So before that, the Roman society was polytheistic. There were many gods. In fact, what made you a senator, and one of the really important parts of being a patrician, was that you had the ability to actually offer sacrifices. So what happens when the church becomes part of the Roman Empire is that there's laws about what the church is. And the famous legal code, there were many laws and codes in Rome. The most famous one is the Justinian Code. And the opening, I know that very few of you have this at home, and to page through and leaf through. In fact, it's really hard to find it in English, because it's mostly in Latin. But the opening thing of the code, there's actually four parts of it, but the legal code is the code of Theodosius, who's an emperor. And I think Theodosius was he the one that Ambrose?
Yeah.
So Ambrose, who's Augustine's mentor in Milan, excommunicates the emperor. Okay? And so Theodosius comes back in, and he in fact writes a law that the church is the church of Rome. Now it's under that law that the Catholic Church is going to operate even after Rome disappears. So in 800, when the Pope crowns Charlemagne emperor, right, that is the Pope of Rome saying to the emperor, who still exists in Constantinople, I'm crowning my own emperor. Take that, patriarch. Take that, emperor of the East. We got our own empire back. So there's no sense in which the church is not up here. In the big circle at the top. And that the structure of the church with its diocese, with its bishops, and its archbishops are taken from Roman governmental unit names. So when the Roman Empire begins to fall apart in the 5th century and 6th century with the barbarian invasions, the church does not. Augustine is going to write City of God, right? Is that it? About why does Rome fall? Why does Rome adopt Christianity as a religion and poof, disappear as an empire? Gibbon is going to write the rise and fall of the Roman Empire and blame Christianity. Okay? So the Christian church is integrally part of the structure of the natural state that persists after the decline of the Roman Empire. And what's its corporate nature? What are its parts? I want to talk about two specific circumstances that occurred historically. One is in 1073. It's called the investiture crisis. There is an emperor. And who's above the pope in Roman law? The emperor. Remember, you got to remember in Roman law, what the emperor is above the law. Okay, so the pope is clearly below the emperor. So there's been an emperor off and on. You know, Charlemagne was crowned Holy Roman Emperor. There are Holy Romans, and Henry IV was a Holy Roman Emperor, and Gregory VII had been a selected pope in 1073, and Gregory was a reformer, and he was really concerned that churches were being sold for money. He was also concerned that priests were living with women, marrying them. Okay. So simony was the sin of selling church offices. What is it for? There's concubinage, but that's not the sin. Does anybody know? Anyway, so Gregory tries to reform this, and what he says to the Holy Roman Emperor, they have this system in which local, powerful individuals appoint the bishop or appoint the archbishop. It's called the proprietary church system, and in fact, it's a system that Charlemagne set up. He encouraged his nobles to, in fact, found churches and support them. And Gregory says, you know what? That's not going to happen anymore. I am going to appoint all the bishops. I'm going to appoint all the archbishops. Okay. Now this has two really interesting implications. The implication we usually think about is the relationship between the Pope and the Emperor. And in fact, Henry IV, who's ruling this motley coalition of Germans and whatever we want to call them, is using the appointment of church offices as part of the privilege that's holding this coalition together. Because the church owns a lot of land, it's really powerful. And so when the Pope says, I'm going to name the heads of the bishoprics and archbishops, the king, and in fact that group is now losing this discretion. It's a real challenge by the Pope to the Emperor. And so Henry says, no, you're not. And so what does the Pope do? He excommunicates him, which is causing all kinds of problems for Henry because he's got to be a Christian prince or people won't obey him. Because he's got this oath that he swears to God, and all of his retainers are swearing their oaths to him. On the back. And now this guy's not a Christian. I don't have to obey him. He's an outsider. He's an other. So Gregory goes to the Pope outside of Canossa, and he kneels in the snow for 3 days, and finally the Pope agrees to bring him back into the fold. Actually, he excommunicates him again later. And the Germans are, wait a minute, what's this Pope doing? You know, this Pope, every time the Pope gets pissed off at the Emperor, he excommunicates him. Isn't this supposed to be theological? Well, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just part of the coalition. Yep.
Was the Pope pissed off at the Emperor, or was the Emperor doing things that weren't kosher?
Well, in fact, what the Pope said is that the purity of the church has been lost. Okay. It's become corrupted. Yeah. Okay? So that now, this will sound really good, everybody. The church should be the representation of the body of Christ on earth. And who is the bishop should not be decided by the emperor. It should be decided by the community of the faithful, who is represented by the Pope. Now, this is the second element, which is the bishops, who are normally being appointed by their local magnates. It could be the emperor, it could be a king, it could be a duke or an earl. They're typically members of aristocratic families who have large land holdings that are being protected, not by the Pope, but by the local king. And so what is the Pope telling to the Archbishop of Mainz? Mainz. You're no longer an independent actor. This is not just the Pope exerting power with respect to the king. This is the Pope exerting power within the church. He's no longer the Bishop of Rome. He becomes not just the first among equals, he becomes...
He became Luther.
Well, he's going to assert this power.
Well, it's basically the same thing.
Well, we'll get to Luther in a sec. Okay, we're going to come back to what Luther says. Because what comes out of this is an agreement between... It's not just an agreement between the church and the state. It's got to be an agreement within the church about what the organizational structure of the church is. This eraser is really weak.
Pens aren't too strong either.
We tend to think of the church and the state as being separated, but in fact, what was happening in the Middle Ages, well, certainly in 1073, is that there were organizations, and boy, this is really weak. Sorry. The circles included both church and state. The patronage networks, the organizational networks, were both religious and secular. Famous, one guy I really like, John Neville Figgis, wrote, in the Middle Ages, the church was the state. And what we call the state was just the police arm of the church. But, oh, great. Thanks.
Bravo.
That was not much better. Well, sort of. Okay. So what was happening is that there was an attempt to create a pan-European political unit, which was unsuccessful, usually. There was a pan-European religious unit, so the political units and the religious units were interrelated. So what happened as a result of the investiture crisis, and it takes a while to figure this out, are two things. One is that the church can propose bishops, and the bishops, the church can then put forward names to the local proprietor, the king or the emperor, but the emperor has the final say.
Okay, so they're beginning to get a constitutional structure here. But it's one that explicitly recognizes the interdependence of the political and secular religious realm. In the 14th century, in 1378, so you know, you get this procedure for selecting the pope, that's called the, who selects the pope? College of Cardinals, okay. The papacy has been in Avignon in southern France. It returns to Rome, and there's a lot of politics involved in who the pope is and things like that. And so the College of Cardinals elects an Italian, and then about 2 months later they decide, we've elected the wrong guy, and they elect a French guy, a French pope. They have two popes. The Constitution of the Church says the College of Cardinals shall select the pope. You know, the smoke comes up the chimney, all that kind of jazz. And so they do it twice. There's two popes. There's an Italian pope and there's a French pope. The French pope goes back to Avignon. There's two papacies. Who do you... There's no rules about this. In fact, the rules that are holding this whole thing together have now not worked. How are we going to solve this problem of having two popes? Well, the pope is above the law. How does the law decide which of the two jokers is really the pope? If the pope has the ability to call a council, which will be really important for Luther, or a council of the church like the Council of Nicaea, right? Just we have a trinity or don't have a trinity. Let's since the Christians are part of the Roman society, let's get these Christians to stop arguing about the nature of God. Okay? Here's the Nicene Creed. Here's what it is. Here's what we believe. And if you don't believe that, okay? So they got to decide. And there's a complicated, long process that leads to the principle, which is decided in 1414, which is like 70 years later, 65 years later, at the Council of Constance, that if there's a situation in which the Pope is acting illegally, right, he becomes a heretic, that a general council can make that decision. And the idea here is that the Pope is being put under the law. So how do you put him under the law? The council is supposed to meet every 5 years. The council has the authority to decide and to discipline the Pope. So when the Pope excommunicates Luther, Luther will say, you can't do that, I can only be excommunicated by a council. The Pope will say, think again, Martin. I ain't calling a council. And in fact, what happened very shortly after the Council of Constance, the Pope stopped calling councils. In fact, I think there's only been four since then. A couple of them in the 20th century, Vatican I and Vatican II. Okay. In fact, the Pope being declared, this was not a durable agreement. The decision of the Council of Constance didn't work in perpetuity. What happened then, and I can see I'm not going to get the corporations, but that's how it goes, we'll talk about it on Friday, is that the church, and of course this is going to be parallel to what happens in the state, is the church had to find a way to depersonalize the Pope. And the solution to this is explained in a great book called The King's Two Bodies by Ernest Kantorowicz. It's called The Political Theology of the Middle Ages. He was a German polymath who came to the United States in the 1930s to escape the Nazi persecution. And what happened was, under the idea of the council, is that and this mirrored what was going on with the states, is that the Pope, when he was coronated in his oath, agreed to respect the property of the Christus. And the Christus was the collective property that the church owned, which was about a third of Europe. And the Pope said he would not alienate, he would not sell the Christus, the property of the body, without the approval of a council. And this was a constitution, so the bishop would not alienate the Christus of the diocese without the approval of the college cathedral. The priest would not alienate the property of the church without the approval of the congregation. Bradley would not alienate the property of St. John's in Atlanta without the church council agreeing to it. Now what that meant was that the Pope as an officer had certain privileges and positions. that did not adhere to the Pope as a person. So there's Gregory the guy who possesses certain rights, and there's Gregory the Pope. And incredibly important, this body was immortal. Not that it would live forever. This guy was corruptible. He would die. But when this Pope died, when Mark dies, we don't want to renegotiate all this stuff all over again with the next guy. So how do we credibly make this office perpetual? How do we create an identity for the Pope, or at the same time for the King, that's not mortal? How do we separate the King as a person from the King as the King? We're going to get to a constitution, right? We don't have any problem distinguishing the President of the United States from George Bush. Or Bill Clinton, or John Kennedy, or George Washington, or Abraham Lincoln. In other words, we're going to create an identity, this chair, that is impersonal. That's an office. That is not a function of the individual characteristics of the person who does it. Now, how? And what's really important here is you can't just create one of these. Because how do you discipline this person if his right is to be above the law? Which means that if he's a jerk, he's going to be a jerk. If he's incompetent, he's going to be incompetent. How do you do that? Okay. Well, in fact, what happened is the council, the Great Council, which is mostly bishops and archbishops and heads of abbots and heads of monasteries and stuff. Excuse me, I got a problem with this chair. This gets an impersonal identity, and the key here is the Pope cannot alienate the property of the church without the approval of the council. The King cannot alienate the property of the fiscus without the approval of the parliament. Okay, that there's some body. This is not an elective representative body. It's made up of officers who have impersonal characteristics defined by their position in the coalition. They're dukes and earls, bishops, as you know, in England. If you were a bishop, you were automatically had a seat in parliament. And there was a negotiation between two perpetually life organizations whose identities did not perish when their members perished. Now, Luther said, this chair cannot excommunicate me. Only this chair can. The Pope said, forget about it, you're excommunicated. We said, no, I believe the gospel. You don't. I know, you know all the whole story. Really complicated. Was Luther trying to start a new church? No, he was trying to reform the one he was in. So when Luther gets out, when the church says you're gone, and a bunch of people say we need to do this, what do they need to do? They need to set up a new church with a new
identity
and organizational structure. So they set up an organization. There's lots of reformers, and they don't all set up the same organization. Luther quickly realizes that if you tell everybody, hey, look, go out and form your organizations, what will happen? Violence! What happens after the Reformation? Violence! What's the next 100 years of European history about?
Violence!
Look, you gotta remember that when you take this stuff apart, even though you're just and good and operating the gospel, you can really screw stuff up! No, I mean, it's funny, because I like to tell jokes. People die. This thing about the law, that's inconvenient. Let's just get rid of it. No! No, don't do that! Kid doesn't like the lawyers, let's get rid of the lawyers. No, don't do that. You know? I'm glad they don't have lawyers in Japan. But that's, their system works differently, believe me. There's ways to adjudicate disputes. We probably, when we look at the way they adjudicate, don't like them compared to what we do, okay? So that what happens in the church, and because the church and the state are so closely connected, it also happens in the polity. When the Reformation comes along, now there's all these questions about what a legitimate church can be. So the Lutherans become a state church, and that requires civil war in Europe, right? Solution in 1630, at the end of the 30 Years' War, will be the religion of the ruler is the religion of the people. The Calvinists break with the Lutherans. They kill each other a lot. What do the Calvinists say? Well, they say you should have a consistory. There should be a constitution for not just the church, but also the secular society of which they're part of. Calvinist churches still have consistories. They still have constitutional structures. Okay. Now, part of that then said, how do we get organizations that conform, that reflect the needs of the religion of the people? Okay, how do we get organizations that can reflect the economic interests of people, political interests? Under a natural state and limited access society, all the organizations that are allowed to form are part of the structure. In the 16th century, Europe, remember when we, if you heard Kit on Monday, in 1500, if you were laying down bets of who was going to be richest society in 2000, you might not lay bets on Europe. You might lay bets on China. You might lay bets on someplace else. There's a book called by a guy named Kenneth Pomerantz, which is really boring. I mean, it's really thick. I mean, it's not like something you pick up and read over the summer. But the point of it is comparing the great divergence between China and Europe after 1500, almost even after, say, 1700. What happens in Europe is they begin to create more sophisticated organizations for the elites. Corporations are one of them. These flow out of the fact that the controversy within the church and between the church and the state since the fall of the Roman Empire has always been conducted in terms of what? The gospel? No, the law. So Luther burns the law books, right? And then he becomes a state church. And he realizes that there's things that the church can do, and the things that the state can do, and they're not the same things. So how do we construct a society which is going to have more powerful organizations and therefore make people more productive? That is a process which is going on in Europe that's not an open access process. It's not intended to let everybody who wants to form an organization. It's intended to make the existing organizations more powerful, and I don't mean they're powerful in the sense of suppression, although that's obviously part of it, powerful in the form of being more productive, allowing people to utilize their resources better. When the Americans become independent in 1776, they write a constitution. What's it called?
Part of your constitution.
How many constitutions do the United States have at the national level?
Articles.
Articles of Confederation. It's really important that I'm a big proponent of learning our own history. They write an Articles of Confederation that doesn't work. It's very weak. The states are really independent. And so in 1787, the Constitutional Convention, we write a national constitution. Today we call it the Constitution, capital T, capital C. And the 9 of the 13 states have to ratify it. Think about inclusion. Oh, we're going to include Delaware even if it doesn't ratify. So some states vote no on the Constitution. Doesn't matter. We're going to force them into the Union anyway. I think North Carolina ratifies in like 1840, something like that. In that Constitution, they write in New York, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, John Jay write a series of essays urging the New Yorkers to accept the Constitution. And those papers are called the Federalist Papers. There's 50 of them or so. Number 9 and 10 are very famous. Number 10 in particular was written by
Madison. And Madison argues that the primary threat to democracy, and he doesn't even say democracy, it's just to a republic. He harkens back to Rome is what? Does anybody know? Faction. The biggest threat to a society organized as a limited access is civil war. It's what brought the Roman Empire down, the Roman Republic down, and got led to the Augustus becoming emperor. It was a major problem in England in the 17th century. They would go through a civil war, the Puritan Revolution. In France, they would go through a civil war in the 1790s. We were participating in a civil war in 1776. We're saying, we want out. We'll kill you. Okay. And what they were worried about in making the Republic work was faction. They were really worried about the cycle that I had on the board the other day in a natural state. That is, the political actors would use the economy to control violence. Meaning, the political actors, a group of interests, would come together and use the political system to create economic privileges to keep themselves in power. That's what they had seen happening in Britain between the end of the Glorious Revolution in 1688 and the events leading up to the American Revolution in 1776. People in Britain were saying that politics was corrupting economics. In a natural state, the political system manipulates the economy to solve the problem of violence. That's how those systems work. Politics corrupts economics, not the other way around. And so the two things that the founding fathers were really afraid of were political parties and economic corporations. They were terrified of organized political and economic interests. That did not want that. By 1850, America will be the first country in the world with mass competitive political parties and will be the first country in the world to adopt open general incorporation. There's something to explain there. When we read the Federalist Papers, we see corporations evil. And if you take, if you're a political science major at an American university, you will read the Federalist Papers. And you will study this Constitution. And you will not study the fact that every state has had, on average, three constitutions. And in the 1830s and 1840s, states dramatically changed their constitutions to open up politics and open up economics. And they decided, and I'll talk more about this on Friday, that the way to protect democracy and a republic was to let anybody who wanted to form an organization. Open access to organizational forms. Churches, schools, businesses, governments would all be open access, and we would put tools in people's hands to actually make those organizations work. We would allow contractual organizations to form at will. Interesting enough, Britain in 1832 begins to move towards more open access democracy, and in 1844 gets General Incorporation Acts. France in 1867 gets General Incorporation Acts, and in 1880 gets open access to politics. They're the first three countries to move, along with the Dutch and the Swiss. All of them decide to open up access to politics and open up access to economics at the same time. Christianity is deeply embedded in this, partly because of the notion of inclusion and access that's in Acts, right? That's in the gospel. But also, it took 2,000 years to figure out, or 1,600 or 1,700 or 1,800 years, that the church should not be part of the state. And the process of figuring that out led the West, after 1,500 or so, to develop much more sophisticated forms of organization, which only after 1,800 that they allow everybody access to. And I know I'm over time. Here's income, here's time, and what's this date?
1800.
modern developed societies are transformed into open access societies. If they are not transformed into open access societies, this kind of growth, which is not just economic growth, it's also political development, doesn't happen. Okay, see you Friday.
Thank you.